Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of outlook could you have on your life or on your fellow human beings if you spent decades serving time for a crime someone else had committed? In a legal system that implores jurors to convict those found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, advances in DNA science and other forensic techniques have demonstrated that justice is not always served. The Reverend Dorothy Budd is a former prosecutor in the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, now an Episcopal deacon at the Church of the Incarnation in Dallas, and author of the 2010 book Tested, How 12 Wrongly Convicted Men Held On to Hope. My other two guests were featured in the book. Billy Smith was cleared for a wrongful aggravated sexual assault conviction after serving nearly 20 years. Richard Miles for a wrongful murder conviction after serving 15 years. The Reverend Budd will be speaking tonight with a panel of exonerees at the Dallas Holocaust Museum Center for Education and Tolerance. Welcome all of you to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Reverend Budd, you worked for years as a prosecutor. How often did it occur to you that you might be, through this process of trying to find the right person and prosecute the right person, in fact sending someone to jail who wasn't guilty?
I was working primarily in the Crimes Against Children unit. So obviously when you're dealing with testimony of very young children, there is a heightened degree of caution and carefulness and evaluation that goes on with each case. So that thought did cross my mind. I have to say that my personal experience in the DA's office was that there was never a time where I came across a case where I thought there was a problem with the evidence, that if I took it up with my superiors, they didn't tell me to take all the time I needed to investigate that case. I'm not sure in some of the cases we see in this book that always happened.
Mm-hmm. Is there like an attitude that you're expected to take in terms of thinking about, as a prosecutor, are you really supposed to be thinking more about the victim than about the person that you are prosecuting?
Well, I think attitudes in the DA's office have changed over the years, so I don't think it's a static thing. But the reality is, in getting ready for a case, you often never see the defendant until the day of trial. In fact, you usually never do, whereas the victim and the victim's family are who you have contact with, so you're hearing that part of the case, and you're hearing the part of the case of the police officer who has prepared the case and wouldn't have brought it in to the grand jury and asked that it be true-billed if they didn't think that they had the right person and weren't then essentially in the process of preparing to convince both the prosecutors and ultimately a jury of that person's guilt. So unless you're looking closely, you sort of hear an already filtered version of the story by definition in how the system works.
Billy, your memory of the day you were arrested, the morning you were arrested, this was an aggravated rape charge, was that it was a particularly beautiful day.
Yes, that was a morning that I'll never forget. It was in the summer, it was August 7th, 1986. And the sun was bright, and the birds were chiming, and I was sleeping on the couch at my sister's house, and a knock came on the door, and the police officer asked my sister, did I stay there, and if I was there, and she said yes, and by the time I jumped up and I come to the door, and I said, I'm Billy Smith, and he said, would you step outside? And then I stepped outside, and it was like such a beautiful morning. I'm just like, I'll just never forget that morning. You know.
And at what point did you realize why they were there and what they thought you had done?
Well, when I heard the officer say there was a lady that said that she had been raped by 2:30 or 3 o'clock that morning, and that she thought that I was the one that had raped her. And so that's when I got up off the couch and I went to the door and I made known that I was Billy Smith, and he asked me to come outside. And when I come outside, standing on the balcony, I could see a lady. She was kind of like making noise and hollering, and she was pointing upstairs as if she was pointing at me. And then that's when he said that this young lady had said she had been raped in the field in the back of the apartments, and that I was the one that had raped her. And I told him, I said, well, it couldn't have been me because I was at home asleep. I never noticed. I don't know this woman. Never seen her. You know, but that's a morning that I'll never forget as long as I live.
In the beginning, did you think, well, surely this will be cleared up? I didn't do this thing, and we have a criminal justice system that is supposed to find who actually did it.
Yes. When he asked me, did I do it, I told him no. He said, well, you know, so he called his superior, and they told him to bring me downtown. So I told myself, I said, oh, it'll be all right. I'll be back. I said, I didn't do this, so I don't have anything to fear. I said, I know I didn't do it. So they just going to take me down and question me, and they're going to find out that I didn't do it, and I'll be back this evening, or I'll be back later on. Well, later on came 20 years later, you know.
Oh, so, Richard, you were convicted on a murder and attempted murder charges. Did you have the same sense initially that they would straighten this out?
Yes, ma'am. I was 19 years old when I was arrested. And in the back of my mind, my father, he was a minister. And so he always stood on the saying, the truth shall set you free. And so when I was incarcerated, that's what I stood on. You know, at some point in time, I knew that the truth was going to set me free. I thought that it was going to be my truth, you know, me just verbally telling them that I was the wrong person, that I didn't have no knowledge of the incident or anything like that. But it wasn't my verbalization of the truth that actually set me free. But I always, I guess, knew that eventually I was going to get out. And as Mr. Billy said, I just didn't think that it would have taken that amount of time or those amount of years out of my life. I couldn't have fathomed, you know, that idea.
Both of you dealt with eyewitness identifications. It must be so surreal to be in court or to see someone in a squad car pointing at you saying, yes, I see that man, and he's the man who committed this crime. Can either one of you describe what that feels like, thinking, I've never seen this person before in my life?
I know when I sat in the jury trial and the gentleman came in, I had never saw this guy before in my life. And it's one thing to know that you're innocent and you know for surety. But when you have somebody come into a courtroom and say, yes, that's the person that did it, and it's like, okay, what's going on now? Where did this guy come from? Who is this guy? Do I look like somebody else? So many different things ran through my head, you know, in that courtroom because I could not figure out. And for 15 years, that was my biggest struggle. How did this gentleman sit in this chair and say I was the person that did this shooting when I was nowhere around the crime scene? So that haunted me for a long time. I was like, okay, did he see me walking home? Did he, how? You know, it was really, really hard, you know.
Do you think it was a mistake?
No, ma'am. I know now after 20 years later, this marks my 20th year. After my exoneration and everything, I know now that the prosecutor in my case had my picture with him. And before the gentleman went in to testify, he told the prosecutor, he said, man, I don't remember this case. I don't even remember the suspect. And even when he went in to testify, he even testified that the skin complexion of the shooter was way darker than I was. The height of the shooter was way taller than I was. But the prosecutor told him to go in and testify against me. So I don't think it was a mistake. I think that the young man was pressured from the prosecutor. You know, you watch the movies of CSI, or we got all of this information on him, and, you know, we understand it. You know, you may not remember, but just go in there. I think the young man was more so pressured than he was mistaken.
Do you all hate those CSI shows where nobody ever makes a mistake, nobody ever pressures anyone to do the wrong thing? I mean, I wonder if those are hard for you to watch from...
Hate may be the wrong word because they're a lot of fun, but I do think there's a whole area when you look through, and there's been a lot of studies now done over the years about what are the causes of wrongful convictions. Over the years, there have been enough of these cases now that you can look back and see what were the factors, and certainly what they call forensic misinformation or junk science has turned out to be a big thing. And I think sometimes those crime shows do make you think that certain pieces of scientific information are actually much more reliable and certain than they are in real life. And it can have tragic results, as it did in Richard's case.
People who haven't been to prison know about the, you know, TV shows and movies where everybody behind bars says, well, I'm innocent. And it's got to – I don't know, first of all, whether that's the case. Do most people say they haven't done it? And was that your experience?
I'm going to say in the county jail, everybody says they're innocent, which is probably, you know, the norm.
It's before they've been to trial.
But when you run into somebody in prison – that's been convicted and they have gotten their time, if they're still saying that they're innocent and they're in prison, it's totally different.
Well, as for me, when I meet people, well, the men that I met in prison that claim they're innocent, I have to say that what makes me believe that they're innocent is because when they come up for parole, in order to make parole, you have to admit that you committed the crime.
And show some remorse, sort of thing.
And show remorse. And so if you're not willing to admit that you did the crime and show remorse, then you automatically is going to be denied parole. So when you take a person that would rather stay in prison, than to, you know, take the easy way out and get out, then, you know, that person probably is innocent. And so I have a lot of friends, men that I met when I was in prison, they claim their innocence. A lot of people would look at me when we'd be talking, I'd tell them that I was innocent, I didn't do it, you know, and it's just that, you know, in that environment, you know, people automatically think, oh, yeah, you say you're innocent, but you here with me. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And so it weighs on you over a period of time. So you have no one listening to you, even the ones that's closest to you. And when you're in prison, you're around at least 2,500 men, you know, during the course of being on that unit. You know, so you see so many people you pass by every day. You're in contact with people every day. You go shower. You go to work. You go to eat and, you know, just go to school around other individuals, and a lot of them claim their innocence. And then there are those that you just see and you just know, man, look, come on, you know. But yes, it's a way that you just kind of like, you know, it's a feeling that you have. And then it's like, if you've been convicted of something that you know you didn't do, then it's kind of like you can feel that energy from someone that's been convicted of something they didn't do. You really can feel that. I really believe that.
Mm-hmm. And, Chris, there's kind of a flip side that's surprising to this. Certainly there are guilty people who say they're innocent. But now that they've started compiling statistics on these cases, a surprising number, I mean, somewhere around 27% of the cases are either false confessions or guilty pleas. So something in the system sometimes weighs so heavily on people that they end up confessing or pleading guilty to things they didn't do. So even in this book, there are men who were there under pleas where, because of their evaluation of what was likely to happen to them in the justice system, they made a calculated decision and swallowed their pride and confessed to something they didn't do and would have lived with it their whole life had DNA not come along and proven the reality of the case.
We're speaking this hour with the Reverend Dorothy Budd, a former prosecutor in the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, now an Episcopal deacon and author of the book Tested, How 12 Wrongly Convicted Men Held On to Hope. Billy Smith is with us as well. He was exonerated for a wrongful conviction after serving nearly 20 years. Richard Miles was exonerated for a wrongful conviction after 15 years. All three will be speaking tonight at the Dallas Holocaust Museum Center for Education and Tolerance. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Richard Miles, who was exonerated for a wrongful murder conviction after serving 15 years. Billy Smith, who was exonerated for a wrongful aggravated sexual assault conviction after serving nearly 20 years. And with the Reverend Dorothy Budd, a former prosecutor in the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, who is now an Episcopal deacon at the Church of the Incarnation in Dallas. And she's author of the 2010 book, Tested, How 12 Wrongly Convicted Men Held On to Hope. All three will be participating in a panel discussion tonight at the Dallas Holocaust Museum Center for Education and Tolerance. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. I have to know how you deal with the frustration of being in a place where you don't belong, and how it seems like both of you started off and you had to learn how to fight, and it was a prison was a dangerous place. How did you cope with that frustration, and also with the frustration of knowing that, that you should be living your real life?
Well, as for me, the 20 years I was in prison, I only had one fight. I chose to take the route of being very careful, because I knew that if I let myself get into trouble in prison, there's many things that could get you in trouble in prison that could cause you to get a case that could actually cause you to be in prison for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
See, being there, knowing that I was there for something I didn't do, being amongst actual criminals who was there for things that they did do, and gang members and all everything that's associated with prison, it could have been easy for me to get involved in something where I could have got a case to where I would still be in prison today. But doesn't mean that I was coward, I was scared, or anything like that. It's just that I chose to take the safe route. And so I looked for other ways to stay away from gangs and other prison issues that, you know, caused you to go bad.
How do you do that? How do you stay out of that?
Well, you know, I had been in prison before, twice before, but there was no reason to send me to prison for something that I didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing, see. And so so I knew how to carry myself. I knew how to deal with prisons. I knew how to deal with the schedules of the things of everyday happening that's going on. But the thing that was hardest for me is knowing that I was there for something I didn't do. And, You can't be in a place like that knowing that you didn't commit a crime and not be affected by the system or by the environment. And so I had to find a way to encourage myself to do better than prison or the happiness on the inside of prison. By that, I meant, you know, in my lowest points or my weakest part of my spirit, I had to reach out and find a source or a power greater than me to be able to deal with that. And so that's when I turned to Islam and I started practicing religion, because I learned that, you know, through this case, it taught me that you're not going to get justice and mercy together. You're going to get one or you're going to get the other. So I didn't get the justice. So the thing that I needed now was some mercy. And that was going to get me through. And I got my mercy through taking the Islamic pledge and becoming a Muslim and practicing the religion and prayer. And prayer kept me so encouraged, because I'd have anything else to hold on to but prayer, you know, and a praise, because everything else was taken away from me. I was denied everything once I got convicted of this crime. And so I had to reach out to a higher power, or I call God or call Allah, and that's what got me through, and that's what continuously gets me through today, because I still have to maintain, and I was able to release the hate and the rage and the anger. And I'm going to tell you a lie. I was very upset. I was very angry when I first went to prison. I didn't work. I didn't do anything. I was on lockup for 2 years before I decided to just let it go, let the hate and the rage and the anger go, and try to do something for myself to change my life, because I always believed that one day I was going to get out. But when I got out, I didn't want to get out angry and mad.
Do you feel like God was waiting for you to come to that realization?
I believe so, because that was a time when I was always told to go to church, do this, that, and other. And as a matter of fact, I had started going to church, believe it or not. I had started going to church before I got arrested, and all of a sudden it just happened. And so I believe that there's somewhere in the Bible says that God says that, you know, when he called for you, you come, but you run. So he had to put me in a place where I could be still, where I could hear his call, and I could come and answer his call. And so I was successful in hearing the call of God, and that's what got me through. Faith is what got me through. Faith and prayer. I tell anyone that. Faith and prayer is what helped me to get through. Without that, you know, I had considered suicide. Mm-hmm. I tell it in the book. It's nothing to be ashamed of. Most exonerees, some exonerees don't want to talk about it, but I know that for a fact, being an innocent man in prison for something I didn't do, that thought comes across your mind. I don't care what exoneree you are, how long you did, or what, but that one thought comes across your mind at least once or twice during the time that you've been in prison. Because why? Because there's nothing, no one hears you, no one wants to hear you, no one's there for you, you don't have a way out. If DNA hadn't became law and was able to release me, Richard, myself, others would still be in prison today. You know what I'm saying? And probably at one point or another, we probably would have gave up, or we would have took on some type of deal going on in prison, mm-hmm. where we'd have hurt someone just out of frustration.
Richard, how did you persevere, and how did you find your way to a place where you could allow some positive energy into your life in a really negative time?
I was blessed, to have my family that was really, really a big support for me.
Your mom and dad visited you like every week.
Oh, man. They were there for me 190% if possible. I remember calling my mom that night when I was arrested, and she knew that I was innocent. A mom's intuition, a mother's intuition. And my father, he was the staunch down Christian type foundation. And growing up, first and foremost, that's all they poured into me. That's the only thing. It was education and church. That's it. That's all we did. We probably went to church. I probably went to church 14 days out the week. But no, seriously. But so growing up with that input, and then getting incarcerated, I think the biggest thing that enabled me to survive, I knew I was innocent. I wanted to prove to my mom and my dad them. Because once I got locked up, it was like the whole world turned against them. Here's this man who's a minister. He has his own church, and his son is incarcerated for murder. The attendance record drops off dramatically. The neighborhood begins to look at them
almost like they were guilty too, right, by association.
They automatically convicted my parents them for me being wrongfully convicted. So at the age of 19, when I entered into the jailhouse, and 20, when I entered into prison, education was my first thing. I got back into school. I graduated from Trinity Valley Community College. And after that, this education board was cut in 1999 to 2000. They stopped pretty much a lot of the education within TDC. And so after that, I began to pursue jobs that were conducive for me using my mind. So I would work in the infirmary. I would work up front, you know, around free world people. You call them free world people in prison because they're not the guards. They're
the staff who are
the
just
staff
dealing with people.
That hasn't put on the gray suit, that do not look at you as an inmate. They look at you as a person. So being around those individuals kind of kept me looking outside, so to speak, instead of just behind the walls. And then also, it was just my faith. I truly, truly believe that that God really, really brought me through this. Because as Billy Smith said, when you're in prison, it's like you're out of there. My case was the first non-DNA, no confession. It's ex parte Richard Miles. Before my case, it was sexual assault crimes. So the possibility for me to get out of prison was slim to none. And I know that I stayed on my knees a lot. I prayed a lot. And I asked God, I said, God, you know, if Joseph is real, show me Joseph. If Moses is real, reveal to me your word in order to get me through this hell. Because the only way I could have got out of prison was if it was something greater than me. Even though I went to the law library and studied about Brady versus Maryland, Strickland versus Washington, Herrera versus Collins, filed my 1107 writ of habeas corpus. Even though it got denied, I educated myself. The Bible says you have to do as much as you can do and then put the rest in God's hands. And I believe that what allowed me to sustain myself for 15 years was God and my family support.
Reverend Budd, when you are ministering to people who are incarcerated, wrongly or not, do you have to first connect with them on a human level before you even sort of bring God into the conversation?
I think that's true of all ministry. You know, so much of what happens is based on relationships. I have to laugh because I remember the first day I met these men, I had gone and asked Craig Watkins. I had begun to think about this issue and said, could I meet the exonerees? And he gathered, I think, 20 of the exonerees, and they came into my husband's law office at Barron and Budd, and I just don't know what I thought was going to happen, but I walked in here, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, with my former district attorney cap in my hand and said, hi, I used to work for Henry Wade in the sex crimes division, and I would like to get to know you all and maybe write a book about your story. And they all went, who are you? And they actually asked me to leave the room, and you should have heard the argument that went on through the walls. And it took us getting to know each other and them having the courage to say, you know, what is this person? What's their motive? What's their heart towards me? And it was a long process of getting to know each other. And I'm just so grateful that they did that with me, because the lives and the hearts they've revealed have taught me so much about what I thought was going to teach me about the justice system. And I have learned a lot about the justice system, but what I really learned a lot about was the human spirit and its incredible resilience in difficult situations.
You both had had previous convictions for much more minor crimes that were unrelated to the things that ultimately sent you away for such a long time. I wonder, though, if you think that that caused the justice system to be biased against you.
Oh, without a doubt, that's the purpose for it. I mean, when you talk about being a habitual criminal, they have that placed in the law, in the procedure, so that if you, it's just like three strikes, you're out. Mm-hmm. And so if you have prior convictions, then they're going to use that to get the maximum sentence for you once you're convicted. And they can't bring it up during the trial unless you open the door, but during the sentencing phase, yes, they're going to use that. They're going to make sure that the jury know that you've been to prison before, what you was in prison for, and how that it is their duty to give you the maximum. Like in my case, the thing that really bothered me once during the sentencing phase of my trial, I had been convicted of robbery and unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. But I had did my time for that. So there was no reason to convict me or seek to convict me for something I didn't do or crime without thoroughly investigating. But this is what the DA said. He said, now, he tried to make this seem like I committed the acts all in the same episode of this aggravated sexual assault. He said,
like you were on some spree. Somehow.
Yeah, I was on some. He said, yeah, here's a man that stole somebody's car, robbed somebody of their money, and on a hot summer night had a little sex. Now, that, to me, inflamed the minds of the jury so much so that they had no choice but to convict me, because he made it look like I committed the two prior convictions on the same night that the current trial that I was on trial for. He made it seem like it was all happening at the same time. And so that's the way they use it. It's like, I believe that when they say that anything you say can and you will be used against you in the court of law, anything that you've done prior will be used against you too. You know what I'm saying? So that's the thing that's one of the things that really it really bothered me the whole time I was in prison, because if it was ever any one thing that made the jurors think that I committed this crime, it was when he made that statement.
I would say for me, I won't say that a person's prior convictions leads to a person's conviction, due to the fact that, as Billy Smith was saying, your prior convictions never come up until the sentencing phase. So during the jury trial, the jury or anybody else in the courtroom, unless you say something about a past conviction, they never know about it. A person is convicted for overzealousness of the prosecutor, evidence that's not being disclosed to the defendant, you know. So that's where false convictions come from. And when a person is convicted, only time your convictions or your prior convictions weigh in on the conviction is during your sentencing phase. And that deals with your time, how much you've already got convicted. So you understand what mm-hmm. I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You've already been convicted. Now we're going to bring up your past so we can give you 75 years. But the damage was done without the jury even knowing about a person's past convictions. So is that
Yeah.
Well, let me explain like this. This is when they open the door. When I mentioned somebody when they open the door, this is how they sometimes trick you to open the door. Now, he asked a question and said, did you graduate from high school? I said, yes, I did. He said, well, what high school did you graduate from? I said, one of them school districts. And where is one of them school districts at? Well, I had to answer the question to take the fifth. Hmm. So when I told him what high school and where it was at, where were you at when you graduated?
You're in juvie.
I was in prison. Mm-hmm. So I had to answer the question. So by me answering the question, that opened up the door. And so the jury got to hear that. And that's when they started talking about my prior and things.
Let me jump in. We're speaking with exonerees Billy Smith and Richard Miles and with the Reverend Dorothy Budd. We will resume our conversation in just a moment. Our number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with exonerees Billy Smith and Richard Miles and with the Reverend Dorothy Budd, a former prosecutor in the Dallas County DA's office who is now an Episcopal deacon at the Church of the Incarnation in Dallas. Her book, published in 2010, is called Tested, How 12 Wrongly Convicted Men Held On to Hope. All three of my guests will be among the participants tonight at a panel discussion at the Dallas Holocaust Museum Center for Education and Tolerance. Join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Michael in Mesquite. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I wanted to thank Reverend Dorothy for her help in pursuit of justice. I myself am a victim as well, as these gentlemen are. My situation was in 1997, and it involved being accused by someone who'd accused another man before, in fact, of sexual assault. And what happened was the detective on the case decided that since there was no DNA evidence, that he would try and find a way to make me guilty. And this was done by taking a series of sheets which I filled out for the statement that I filled out after having violated my Fifth Amendment right. After I told him I didn't want to fill out or sign anything, but he insisted on it anyway. I filled out these forms, and he went ahead and took confession sheets and wove them into the stack, left saying he was going to make copies, and then reappeared a few minutes later and had me sign the bottom of all the papers.
I see you nodding your head. Reverend Budd.
That's actually an area that is, you know, very, very in the midst of being worked on. They're trying right now in the legislature but haven't succeeded thus far to make it the standard in Texas that all confessions and all interrogations be audiotaped or videotaped so that that kind of thing can't happen. But right now that's not the law of the state. Some police units have that and some don't. But it does seem odd that, you know, you're essentially videotaped every time you walk into a store. But the one thing that we don't keep records of is confessions, because false confessions or manufactured confessions are an issue in some of these cases. There's no doubt about it.
So it bears noting, of course, there are bad actors out there in the criminal justice system. Certainly there are people in this world who commit terrible crimes. No one is saying that guilty people shouldn't be punished or you know, brought to account for what they've done wrong. On the other hand, what we've described sounds so very corrupt from the police department through, let's just call it, the past history of prosecutors. Was it your experience? Was everything rife with corruption, Reverend Bott?
No, that's not what I found at all in my experience. And I don't think anyone wants to play, you know, blame the police officers, blame the DA, or blame the victims, certainly, because, you know, these are real crimes that have real victims. The problem is if the system isn't set up to do everything it can to ensure that you are, in fact, getting the right person in the system, that doesn't help the victim, the police, or the DA. Mm-hmm. And so certainly there are instances of individual corruption. But what I think is more the case is you have a complex system that has lots of moving pieces. Someone enters the system. They come under the eye of scrutiny. Somewhere in that system, a mistake gets made. And if they're the proper checks and balances, people are using the proper lens to look at things, they're asking the hard questions, some of those mistakes get caught. If they don't and it just snowballs and you say, okay, I picked this person up, maybe they have a prior offense or maybe they seem to match the description, something makes you think that person is guilty, but you don't take the time to truly investigate, to look at all sides of it, to ask the hard questions, and they don't get asked, and the cases just roll. And that's when justice gets miscarried all the way up to the jury, you know, so that you have people just kind of at the final analysis, are they going to be able to ask the hard questions and look with fresh eyes at the evidence that's put before them? Because ultimately, we're all stewards of our justice system.
Now that I'm a wrongful conviction survivor, and that's how I see myself, as being a wrongful convicted survivor, because I was able to survive. Tim Cole, he was posthumously exonerated. He died in prison. But seeing myself as a survivor and as a victim myself of wrong conviction, then, like, I look at, and I'm, while she was talking, Rambo was talking, I was thinking in terms of, like, when I got arrested, the same protection and the same courtesy and same particulars that the police department effort that they put to find the person that did harm this woman or assaulted this woman, the same rights that she had for them to pursue the justice. When they stopped me or when they came to my sister's house and arrested me, they should have gave me that same courtesy. They should have gave me that same amount of priority in seeing that I was not the person. Because, see, even though I was arrested for it, I still had rights. Mm-hmm. I still had rights that I was supposed to have been protected, because you're not supposed to just protect one side. I was supposed to be protected, too, because our police officers are trained to protect and serve, but that didn't come with me. I didn't get that. I got another treatment. And when they called down and they found out that I had a record, that throwed all that out the window. And so I was never offered the opportunity to be sought justice in the beginning, because it was just like, you know, okay, he did something before, so this has got to be the guy.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? And the thing that's really bugged that is that this woman, I was a friend with the apartment complex manager. Now, she was supposed to have been his common-law wife, and they were supposed to have been married or been common-law living together for 2 years. I used to go to his house every other day playing dominoes, having fun, drinking a beer with him, sitting out on by the pool at the apartment complex we lived in, and I never saw this woman. So, you see, until the day, the morning, the first time I saw when they come and call me out to the balcony. But where was my rights? Where was the question in their mind, like they was taking her word automatically over mine? So, see, when you talk about being innocent and you're talking about being wrongfully convicted, it goes deeper than what the eyes can see and way people view us or how people can say, well, okay, DNA cleared you, but, yeah, you something happened there.
Yeah.
Because you got arrested. So it's a whole lot that weighs on us, you know, when you're wrongfully convicted.
I don't know how either of you will feel about answering this question, but you both did time for crimes that you didn't commit, that other people had committed. Yeah. You did crime with people, many of whom were rightfully convicted. We talk so much about prisons making more criminals, making better criminals. Are there things that we could do to change the system? And I ask you this because even as innocent men, you're in a position to have observed the penal system in a way that most experts aren't. Could we make prison different so that it becomes a place of rehabilitation rather than simply human warehousing?
Obviously, there's not going to be a lot of trust between convicts and the outside world. There's never going to be that kind of trust. Never going to have that. But what I see that can do things to happen or make individuals in prison have an opportunity to change their lives is that you have to keep education in the system. See, they've primarily taken education out of the system. When I was there, education was so free, and you could take up to at least 5 classes. Now, somewhere along the line, when I was driving to get my 2-year associate's degree, because of what I was in prison for, my focus, I lost my focus so great that I stopped. Mm-hmm. I quit at 27 hours, and I still haven't completed it yet. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, but I think that if you take the educational system out, then you're going to lose them completely. But if you keep education there and you keep places where they can have opportunities to train and get the skills to better themselves and also because they're taking the trade systems out too. They're not letting you just take trades that you're going to be able to use when you get out. See, so there's like I say, education, trade system, schooling and things like that. If they can continue that and they can really offer it and put people in places that's really going to make sure that the people get proper education while they're in there and give them psychological training and counseling and stuff like that, yeah, that's plenty that can be done to help people stay out of prison while they're in prison.
Richard?
pretty much piggybacking on what Mr. Billy Smith was saying, in 2012, I was finally exonerated, and I started an organization called Miles of Freedom. The reason why I started Miles of Freedom was because of the injustices that I experienced in prison. In 2000, the budget cut hit prison, which took away any accessibility of higher education. They have taken a lot of things that are pretty much conducive for a person that's coming out of prison. You have family members that can't even get down to see their loved ones. You have a lot of things that go on inside the prison system. You have people that go in. I've seen people go to the infirmary and just vent about why they're locked up, and they end up on medication. So you are turning a lot of people into, what's the word? They have psychological problems. That's what I'm thinking of. So you have a person that gets incarcerated and they eventually ends up taking medication just to sleep, and now they become a Thyrazine patient. So you're doing all of these things to these individuals, and they're also working for free. I worked for free for 15 years. If you start paying them something while they're down there working, that could teach them money management, that could give them something on their books that could help them when they get out. Re-implementing education And then our reentry assistance, when a person is released from prison, having organizations out here that are really concerned about a person not reoffending, having organizations out here that really key in on some of the factors that make a person go back into prison, you know, because we are lost when you come out of prison. 15 years from Dallas, and now they just open up the door.
Everything's changed.
Everything. Mm-hmm. It was no trains in Dallas when I left. It was no cell phones in Dallas when I left. And so when I came home, after I was exonerated, I was like, okay, it's took me this long to think about relationships. You know, think about that, where you are isolated from women. And in a man's penitentiary, in a man's prison, you long for that. Mm-hmm. And then when you get out, you really don't know how to communicate with women because you haven't really been around.
It's like being in seventh grade again.
You're starting. I was 19 years old when I got back out. Mm-hmm. Even though I was 34 years old,
yeah,
I was 19 years old in a 34-year-old body.
Mm-hmm.
Society had a lot of expectations of me because I was 34. But I was handicapped because of where I had been, because of the isolation that I had been placed in. So it is a lot that we can do as a society, as a community, and as individuals to really help people that are incarcerated. Yes, they have committed crimes. But the reality is, every day people wake up in prison. Prison is not just a physical place. You have people in prison in relationships. You have people in financial prisons, in spiritual prisons. And in each person's transition, they need reentry. They need assistance.
Final thoughts from you, Reverend Bud.
I think my final thought would be that there's all kinds of issues that you can be involved in the world, but every now and then there's an issue that just kind of touches your heart. And I think to think about that there have been so many men, especially in our particular city. Dallas has essentially leads the nation for someplace its size in having found people that have been wrongfully incarcerated. You know, that when you have an issue like that, I think it's a call for justice and a call for us to be willing to do some hard reflective thought about how we can be involved and how we can take ownership of our legal system. We have a wonderful legal system that's a gift to us in this country, but it's only a gift if we do the hard work to make it work right so that justice is done.
The Reverend Dorothy Budd is a former prosecutor in the Dallas County DA's office, now an Episcopal deacon at the Church of the Incarnation in Dallas, and author of the 2010 book, Test It, How 12 Wrongly Convicted Men Held On to Hope. Billy Smith was exonerated after 20 years, Richard Miles after 15 years. All three of my guests will be panelists tonight at the Dallas Holocaust Museum Center for Education and Tolerance. It's been wonderful to talk with all of you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Think is produced today by Lindsay Connect. We had help on the phones from Christina Ulsh. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Stephen Becker is producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.